edition of the debate. I'm Kavita Ahwai. Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, objected to the U.S. Senate's demand for being briefed about the contents of the recently signed roadmap of cooperation between Tehran and the IAEA. He's also warned the U.N. nuclear watchdog to avoid disclosing its secret agreements with Tehran. That is our topic for this edition of the debate.
Iran has warned the International Atomic Energy Agency against revealing the text of a deal signed by Tehran and the IAEA. Iran's envoy to the agency, Reza Najafi, has stressed that the agreement is confidential. IAEA's Director General Yukiya Amano is scheduled to visit Washington to meet with the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations on Wednesday. The Iranian official said the agency knows very well what the revelation of confidential texts would mean. Najafi, however, said Amano's trip to the U.S. probably aims to help facilitate the approval of Iran's nuclear talks conclusion with the P5+1 group of countries at Congress.
As far as their agreement with Iran is, no, they're not supposed to, not only with Iran, with any member of the NPT. They cannot share that information. Now, the fact, as you said, he's coming to U.S. on Wednesday to be in front of the Senate, it may help push the Senate to at least not to be so much into the opposition of this agreement and perhaps give a chance for this agreement to move forward. So that would be the positive thing about Mr. Obama. But sharing those secrets, I'm not sure if he's, by law, it's allowed to do that. I think it would be not appropriate for him to do that.
Tehran has already made it clear that it won't allow foreign inspectors to visit its military sites. Tehran says the IAEA gave a list of Iranians' nuclear scientists and other information to the Western intelligence agencies in the past, which finally ended up in the hands of Israel. Later on, several sabotage attempts were made against Iranian nuclear facilities. A number of scientists were assassinated in Iran. Some Western media outlets have all but confirmed that the Israeli regime was behind the assassinations. Iran also made some arrests and sentenced at least one terrorist to death by hanging. Many would now watch Amano's visit to the U.S. with a sense of déjà vu. As for the rejection of calls for the inspection of Iranian military sites, observers say there's no guarantee that inspectors would not relay the information about the facilities to Iran's enemies, most particularly the Israeli regime.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate. We have Elham Kadkhodai. She is a political commentator who joins us in the studios. And from Washington, we have Michael Lane. He's the founder of the American Institute for Foreign Policy. I'd like to welcome both of our guests, and let me set the stage with you first, Elham Kadkhodai, and refer to what Iran's envoy to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, has said, and I'm quoting him: "The agreements signed between a member country and the IAEA are definitely secret and cannot be presented to any other country at all." This was during an interview that he made this statement. Can you elaborate more on what Mr. Najafi has said?
Yeah, well, regarding this issue, what we have to consider is that Iran has legitimate concerns regarding what the IAEA is going to do with the information it has. Because if we take a look at a brief look at the history of Iran's cooperation with the agency, we see that in many instances the agency has leaked information, sensitive information, to third parties. For example, we have the case of the Iranian scientists who were assassinated. Many Iranian officials have stated that the information regarding these scientists, their names, they have been leaked to third parties by the IAEA. So what Iran's ambassador has stated is based on Iran's legitimate concerns, which are based on hard facts regarding the history of Iran's cooperation with the agency.
Well, Michael Lane, you know, this has been something that also has been requested by the Senate. And of course, it comes as a surprise to many outsiders, common people perhaps, that there is such type of arrangement to begin with. But U.S. Senate has also requested them to be briefed about the contents of this recently signed roadmap of cooperation between Tehran and the IAEA. And of course, Iran has said that that is not going to happen. it's multifaceted the way that this has been dealt with by the Obama administration, but overall, they're saying that they're going to brief them. Let me start out with that general question. They're going to brief the U.S. senators, politicians on Capitol Hill about the contents of this. Is there a legal right that the U.S. Senate can request such a thing from Reza Najafi, Iran's envoy to the IAEA, and Iran in particular?
Yes, the United States Senate can request any information it believes it needs to give fair and due consideration to any proposal that might be deliberated and voted on by the Senate in a subsequent action. Now, the question is not do they have the right to ask for it, but what happens if they are dissatisfied or if they don't get what they need? It's not unusual or not unexpected that they would ask for a lot of things that they would not get. The question now is, does this roadmap come under the umbrella of something that they will get or something that they won't get? My guess is that the IAEA understands that it has a confidential agreement with the government of Iran. It also understands that its credibility is on the line, and if it starts openly breaching confidential documents, that Iran would probably consider itself no longer bound by the terms and conditions of that document. So what you're going to see in this briefing this week in front of the Committee on Foreign Relations of the United States Senate is sort of a broad characterization of what is in the document, of how the IAEA would go about not only doing its job of the inspections, but meeting any anticipated challenges or unanticipated challenges that it might encounter during the inspection process. Whether or not that broad characterization of the IAEA efforts is going to satisfy 34 members of the United States Senate, who will then vote to sustain President Obama's veto of the resolution of disapproval, is of course something that we won't know until later in the game.
Okay, let's elaborate a little bit more, Elham Akhadkhodai, about what Michael Lane has said there. I'm going to put this in the context of what is the opposite of what Michael Lane has said, and that comes from Iranian nuclear officials. Now, Michael Lane says, yes, Congress or Senate can request this from Iran. But legally, this is what senior Iranian nuclear officials have said. They have said that the IAEA members have such secret agreements and that the UN nuclear watchdog is duty-bound to keep them secret to any third-party individual or state. Now, the U.S. is third-party. The Congress members are third-party in this case, although U.S. Senator John Kerry has said, while the documents are confidential, all members of Congress will be briefed in closed-door sessions. This was his answer to Senator John McCain. So, why isn't the briefing that John Kerry is going to give as a Secretary of State enough to satisfy the U.S. and keep Iran's private details regarding this the contents of this roadmap of cooperation?
Well, I think, first of all, to begin with, I have to say that, you know, this request by the American congressman to be informed about all the details of the side agreements that Iran has had with the IAEA, this is not actually an excessive demand. I mean, they can request this, but this request is not based on any legal right that they might have. Because as the American Secretary of Energy has stated, this is standard procedure, this is standard practice for the agreements between the IAEA and other members of the agency to be secret and to be confidential. So I think the problem here is that if the IAEA wants to play a constructive role in the joint agreement between Iran and the P5+1 being a success, the agency has to prove its independence. That's very important. It has to prove that it's trustworthy, that Iran can trust the agency to verify its whether Iran is actually abiding by its obligations. So, and also part of building that trust is for the head of the agency to, you know, prove that he's independent and he's not accountable to foreign governments or, you know, foreign lawmakers. stressing the independence of the agency is a very important fact here. And I think the problem and the issue is not just related to Iran, because I think this is this concerns the overall reputation of the agency. If what's been happening before of the agency leaking information to third parties, if that's going to be repeated, I think the agency's reputation is going to be damaged, and that's going to cause other member states to feel that they can't trust the agency, and you know it's going to lessen their incentives for cooperation with the agency, and that's, I think, going to, it's going to damage the agency's overall effort in non-proliferation.
Of course, that is a very good point that you make there, about the fact that Michael Lane, she mentioned about the fact that, any release of this information is going to damage the agency, which is somewhat of a shaky ground when it comes to the issue of trust when it comes to Iran. You mentioned the Iranian nuclear scientist assassinations and other leaks that have been done by the agency. But what I'm curious about is, Michael Lane, it appears that there may be an onus on Iran here. But then again, maybe there's something that the U.S. Perhaps doesn't want for it to be revealed. I know that Iran's envoy to the IAEA has come out saying the agency should not release these details. Do you think that there's something within this agreement that neither party wants it to become public information of any kind because it contains, well, I don't know, fill in the blank, sensitive information maybe, Michael Lane? Take a whack at it.
Well, typically these things are confidential because there's something in there that would be either misinterpreted or interpreted badly or something like that if it became general knowledge, or it contains sensitive information that would violate a country's sovereignty, which I think is what the government of Iran has said that it's concerned about, is it has national security concerns and things like that, that it would be very much opposed to if the IAEA was to release any of those details to countries that might be perceived as adversaries or even enemies of the government of Iran. I think the setup piece mentioned Israel as being one of those. There's a great deal of distrust or mistrust between Iran and the IAEA, not knowing how they're going to do this. I can tell you in the West, there's a great deal of distrust. The average American views the UN with a great deal of skepticism and distrust. The average member of Congress views the UN with a great deal of skepticism and distrust. It's the strong part for this agreement is that the Obama administration, which is primarily in the driver's seat, has enough of a trust level in the IAEA that they're pushing forward with this particular agreement, notwithstanding not having seen, but claiming general knowledge of what is in the roadmap agreement between the IAEA and Iraq. Ultimately, it comes down to this. What does the Obama administration need to do to get 34 votes in the Senate and one-third of the House of Representatives plus one? And they are, of course, planning, and they believe right now that these kind of details are not going to be necessary to be revealed or shared with members of Congress in order to get to that one-third plus one vote in each House of Congress. I think, again, the clock is ticking. We're moving towards an eventual vote in a period of time, and we don't really know. This is the preliminary dancing. This is just sort of, getting to know each other. When it comes to the hardcore negotiating as to who's going to vote how on the vote to override the president's veto, those decisions by wavering senators and members of Congress will be made in the last 48 hours.
And I think that may be the focus of this whole thing, Elham Khatkhodai, when it comes to Iran's nuclear conclusion being accepted on the American side, not particularly the Obama administration, but perhaps these senators who are reviewing this with skepticism, to say the least. Mm-hmm. How much do you think Israel is playing a factor in this whole scenario when we have AIPAC, for example, pushing to get this deal thwarted, to basically have it obstructed in any shape or form? But your reaction to Israel's role in this whole affair?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would just like to add a small point in that, as I said, the fact of the deal between the IAEA and member states being a secret and being confidential is standard practice. We have the example of South Africa, where, as you know, even today, parts of its agreement with the agency still remain confidential. So I would just like to emphasize that this is not something specific to Iran. Regarding the role of Israel, I mean, Israel has played a very significant role from the very beginning of this whole crisis, whole manufactured crisis, by inflating the problem, making baseless accusations regarding Iran. The issue with Israel is that they are not after any peaceful solution to this problem. Maybe today, being pressed by peace activists and the media, what they're saying now is that we want a better deal. But I believe that they want no deal at all. The overall Israeli policy in the region has been to make problems. They are not interested in stability in their Arab or Muslim neighbors. So I think whatever deal, if whatever deal had been reached, they would never have supported that and been in agreement with that, because their overall policy is instability in the region.
Michael Lane, I'm reading what Senator Ted Cruz has said. 2 p.m. This would be 2 p.m., let's see, Washington time, July 31st. Senator Ted Cruz, who came out and said, you know what, we don't know about these side deals, and this deal with the IAEA, we need to know about it. He said, if we don't, I'm going to push members of Congress to extend the voting that's going to take place if it beyond the 60-day period. Do you think that that is a motion that could become a reality based on what Senator Ted Cruz has said?
Senator Cruz is running for president. Senator Cruz is looking to make headlines, and this is a very easy way for Senator Cruz to make headlines and play to the base constituency that he views as likely to support him in the primary process. Notwithstanding that, I believe Senator Cruz's point is that since the president has not yet transmitted officially the document to the and he by the document he means the whole thing, including side deals, to the Congress, that means that the 60-day clock has stopped ticking. I don't think he's going to be successful in that. He would need to get not only 50 plus one votes in the Senate, but would likely need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. And I rather suspect that that's not going to happen. There are many Democrats who might be inclined to vote against the deal that would not be inclined to vote to extend the clock for that reason. Let me go back to your question that you asked before just briefly. Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very open that he from his perspective, from his people's perspective, thinks this is a very bad deal. And he's been very open about the fact that he is lobbying as strenuously as he can to see the deal defeated in the United States Congress. Notwithstanding that, at the end of the day, each member of Congress who votes on this has two things in their mind. First and foremost is this deal in the best interest of the United States? Will it lead to safety, stability, security, et cetera, in the region? Is it a good deal for the United States, and is it a good deal for the world? But secondly, each member of Congress, unlike other countries where your elective fate is not always in your own hands, the elective fate of each of our members of Congress is in their own hands. They are held accountable, not as a party, but as an individual for the votes that they cast. And they will, of course, have their eyes on the public opinion polls and be judging whether or not it would be an easier path to re-election or a more difficult path to re-election should they vote yay or nay on this particular issue.
Okay, we're quickly running out of time, and I'm going to ask you, Elham Khatkhodai, a very analytical type approach to this whole Iran you mentioned manufactured crisis, and that is really something that directs the question that I have, and that is that Israel, for example, the people who are afraid of this nuclear conclusion, like Israel, like perhaps even Saudi Arabia, they know that Iran is not an existential threat. They realize that. The crisis was manufactured. What they are worried about is the further rise of Iran. They're worried about the fact that Iran will become more of a regional power. And that is what is worrying them. Do you think that is the angle that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and perhaps any other countries, maybe out of the Persian Gulf countries, feel towards Iran when it comes to this whole nuclear conclusion?
Yeah, well, I think there's a fundamental difference between how Iran sees the world and what's happening in the region and how the Israeli regime and the Saudi regime see it. I think the important point about Iran is that what's important for Iran and what's the source of power for Iran is the support of its people. And what Iran truly believes in is that in each and every country in the region, truly the people should decide about the fate of their countries. While on the other side we see that the Israeli regime, the Saudis, they are relying on their military power and the money that they receive either from foreign aid or from their oil reserves. So you see the problem with the Saudi airstrikes in Yemen, which are supported by the United States, killing civilians every day. That's not going to increase Saudi power. They might think that using this military might, killing ordinary civilians, this is a commonality between the Saudis and the Israelis. Easily killing civilians, killing small children. They think that using these methods, they can obtain more and more power in the region. And they are simultaneously very jealous of what they call Iranian hegemony, right, which I don't agree with. That's not hegemony. That's because Iran has always been supportive of democracy, okay, in the region and of people deciding their own fate.
Sorry, I got to jump in. Thank you very much for that. We're unfortunately fresh out of time. Yeah. That was Elham Khatkhodai, political commentator, talking to us in the studios. And Michael Lane, thank you, founder of the American Institute for Foreign Policy, who spoke to us from Washington. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitavi and the entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.